From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. And we start today with the 2020 campaign. Senator Cory Booker is hosting a Memorial Day barbecue in Polk County, Iowa. Mayor Pete Buttigieg and Senator Bernie Sanders are on the trail in New Hampshire. So is former Republican Governor Bill Weld. And as we dive headlong into the summer campaign, there's an effort underway to get the candidates talking about something that usually gets less attention, issues important to people with disabilities. Andrew Polrang is co-founder of the Twitter hashtag CryptTheVote. Andrew, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
And CryptTheVote, explain, what does that mean?
Well, it's a hashtag that we came up with to basically tie together conversations on Twitter about people with disabilities in politics. And specifically, we started it around the 2016 election and the lead up to that, and have continued it ever since.
I'm surprised you use that phrase, CRIP, though. Can you explain why you would do that?
Well, yeah, you're not the only one. It's partly to kind of draw attention, and it does refer to sort of a slur, but it's also, for a long time in the disability community, some of us, at least, have used it kind of as a reclaimed thing, kind of ironic and with a little bit of pride. So it's a little bit of a twist on an insult.
Does having a disability tend to affect the way that people vote on election day?
That's kind of hard to tell. Some of the studies that have been done indicate a slight, you know, leftward lean in the disability community, but as far as I've seen, not a whole lot. And part of our conversation is discussing amongst ourselves, well, what does it mean? Does it change how we would otherwise vote if it wasn't for the fact that we were disabled?
Well, nonetheless, the candidates are paying attention. Here's Democratic Senator Elizabeth Warren speaking in Massachusetts earlier this year.
And we can't be blind to the fact that the rules in our country have been rigged against other people for a long time. Women, LGBTQ Americans, Latinos, Native Americans, immigrants, people with disabilities, and we need to call it out.
And here's South Bend, Indiana Mayor Pete Buttigieg, who also knows American Sign Language, answering a question from Jennifer Laszlo of the disability advocacy group Respectability back in April.
Can I ask you if you'll be putting people with disabilities in your campaign ads
Absolutely.
In the future and on your staff?
What's that?
And on
yes.
your staff?
Yes.
He said yes when asked if he would put people with disabilities on his staff. Bernie Sanders says on his website that the civil rights of people with disabilities are not always protected. Are you surprised by how much attention this issue has gotten so far this election?
Actually, I'm not surprised. You know, mentioning people with disabilities along with other groups who are not well represented does happen. It's happened before. I think it's a good sign that it's happening early. And as far as I think the one thing that is somewhat new, the question of having people with disabilities on campaign staff and administrations, that's something that we're seeing as a trend in our community of CryptTheVote that wasn't totally there early when we started, that it isn't just policy, it's participation.
Healthcare, clearly an important issue for people with disabilities. What are you hearing from the candidates this year, and what do you want to hear?
Well, we are hearing more of a recognition that healthcare policy includes some very specific things that affect people with disabilities, such as long-term care. It was interesting that in 2016, when various ideas about universal health care were really being taken somewhat seriously, it was interesting to us and encouraging, but it was upsetting that none of the plans at that time addressed, like, how do you get care in your home to live independently, which is part of health care but wasn't really part of the plans. Now they really are. More and more of these plans are taking into account. Not all of them, but, you know, a lot more than were before. So that's progress.
Will you be endorsing anybody in this election?
No, we don't endorse, and we're a nonpartisan conversation.
Well, regardless of who wins the nomination on the Democratic side, the candidate they're probably going to be running against is President Trump. We know over the years he's made some derogatory comments about people with disabilities. Last year, he said the Paralympics were inspiring but also, quote, tough to watch. And, of course, he was criticized for mocking a reporter with a physical disability on the campaign trail. What's your message to the president in this election year?
Well, it's hard to say that I have a message for him on that. I mean, these are pretty obviously offensive statements, and he shouldn't be making them. The more interesting thing to me is, and from what we've observed, you know, we acknowledge these things and we don't like them, but they don't draw quite as much interest from the actual disability community as they do from everyone else, which is kind of interesting.
Why do you think that is?
Well, we're focused on policy and practices, not necessarily just rhetoric. But I think also some of it has to do with we're not surprised by this. We experience, some of us more than others, but all of us have experienced ableism in our actual real lives. We know that it exists and that it's relatively common. So there's that shock value, I think, is not quite there for us. So yes, we say, yeah, oh, there we go. That's really terrible. But we don't make that – what more is there to say? You know, after that, there's not much more to add. And we go on and we discuss healthcare and employment and the Americans with Disabilities Act and, you know, things that actually, you know, affect people's lives.
That's Andrew Polrang. He's co-founder of the Twitter hashtag CripTheVote. Andrew, thanks for speaking with me.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
Congressional Democrats want answers from the Trump administration in the case of a migrant girl from El Salvador who died in U.S. custody last September. She is one of six migrant children who've died in the care of the federal government in the past 8 months. The 10-year-old had heart defects. Her death was not disclosed until last week. Right now, the White House is asking Congress for $2.8 billion to deal with a surge of unaccompanied migrant children crossing the border. The time it's taking the government to release migrant kids to parents and other sponsors in the U.S. has more than doubled since 2015. KQED's Farida Javala Romero has this report.
Pamela Baez says kindergarten students walk in a line to meet their parents at the end of the school day in the city of Pinole in Northern California.
Hold my hand. Oh, you gotta hold my hand.
The last place Baez worked was an agency for migrant children in New York. The hundreds of kids who are sent to that center have classes and counseling and are temporarily housed with foster families. Before the children are released, the government first has to screen their parents or sponsors to be sure the kids will be safe. That vetting process took about a month on average in 2015. Now the average is 2.5 months. Baez says the kids she cared for were desperate to leave.
The case manager will come and be like, unfortunately, now you have to stay 2 more months. Then to the point that children started asking if they could be deported back to their country.
The New York agency is called Cayuga Centers. Baez says the children are already traumatized, and keeping them away from their families harms them more.
Seeing how they're suffering, I will have kids in my classroom that the next day I will find out that they had even self-harmed themselves.
A spokesman for Cayuga Centers said in a statement, the safety and well-being of children is paramount, and using foster families is better than detention at shelters, where most unaccompanied minors end up. Like Angel, a 17-year-old from Guatemala, he spent almost 3 months locked in a shelter in Florida. Angel recently attended a legal orientation in San Francisco with his cousin, Santos, who sponsored his release. We're not using the family's last name because of their immigration status. Santos says the teen doesn't talk much about the shelter. He hopes time will heal his trauma.
El tiempo lo curará las heridas, lo que uno se trae o las experiencias, el trauma que se trae uno.
To get custody of Angel, Santos and his wife had to provide lots of documents and get fingerprinted.
El gobierno aquí también pide mucho papel.
They knew it was a risk because Immigration and Customs Enforcement now runs background checks on potential sponsors. The agency arrested about 170 of them last year because they were undocumented. Congress limited the use of that data for immigration enforcement, but people are still scared, says Millie Atkinson, an attorney with the Immigration Center for Women and Children.
the climate towards immigration right now in this country is inducing a lot of fear for people who in the past may have stepped forward to sponsor a child.
The Office of Refugee Resettlement declined to comment on why it's taking longer to release kids, but officials say they're receiving more unaccompanied children, 32,000 between October 2018 and March 30th. That's an increase of almost 50% over the same period last year. At Pamela Baez's school in Pinole, she says she often remembers the distress she saw in the migrant kids in New York.
The more these children are staying in these centers, the more it's affecting their mental health. And eventually, many of these children end up being part of our society.
In the past 4 years, thousands of children have reported sexual abuse in U.S. custody, often by other detained kids. And in April, a 16-year-old boy became ill and died at a shelter in Texas. Advocates worry that as facilities get more crowded and staff are stretched thin, the risk for migrant children will increase. For Here and Now, I'm Farida Yapala Romero.
It was nearly four decades ago that Dustin Hoffman put on a dress and heels for the movie Tootsie to play the out-of-work actor Michael Dorsey, auditioning for a woman's role in a soap opera.
I'm an actress. I'm a character actress. I can play this part any way you want.
You may remember he got the part, but not without a few complications. Well, nearly four decades later, a new musical version is getting raves on Broadway. Tony nominee Santino Fontana stars as Michael Dorsey. In this version, he auditions for the role of Juliet's nurse in a farcical sequel to Romeo and Juliet. The new show is cleverly updated for the times, and it's as relentlessly funny as it is relevant. Here and Now's Karen Miller-Medson met with Fontana, writer Robert Horn, and composer David Yazbek backstage after a recent performance.
Hey, how are you?
Nice to meet you.
Before we get into any part of the plot, I have to say that falsetto. I mean, you open your mouth.
Santino?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. That's terrible.
You open your mouth for the audition scene to become the nurse in musical Romeo and Juliet, and you belt out this falsetto.
Come and come back to town. How to watch and feed me to do. A promise I'll always come through. Just call and I'm there. I'll let you down.
Is that like a superpower?
No, I don't think it's a superpower. I don't know if it's really a falsetto. It's just a different extension of how are we going to make these two characters different? And that was over the 3 years of developing the show came into focus.
I have to ask you, David Yazbek, who wrote this music, did you have Santino in mind when you wrote this? Or did you think there were... someone else in the country who had that range?
I had Leonard Cohen in mind when I was writing the show. No, I mean, I didn't. Most of the stuff that I wrote, I didn't know Santino was going to be in the show. Thank God he is in the show. Because when I was writing it, I had no concern or thought for the person who was going to have to do it.
In one rehearsal, we added something where there's like a high D.
Oh, that's right.
And David was like, came up to me after the run through and he was like, can you do that? And I was like, you mean what I just did? And he's like,
yeah.
So let's talk a little bit about the book. You know, in 1982, just putting on a dress was funny. You know, it's been a genre. Men in a dress equals funny. But it was before Me Too, and it was when, you know, a man telling a woman how to fix her relationship problems was quaint. You know, the whole mansplaining thing. And so... when one sees it, it doesn't necessarily scream, let's do it again, even though everyone appreciates that movie. That's the whole way of saying, why Tootsie?
Well, for a number of reasons. One, at the core, the DNA of this story is about
a man who is desperate, who is told you can no longer do the one thing you love more than anything. And what would you do in your life if somebody told you that? And he makes some very stupid choices, which is great setup for farce and for theater. And once we knew that that was all we had to honor and that we could write our own version of Tootsie based on that and then bring back from the movie anything or nothing that we wanted to use, it all sort of organically started to take shape.
And you do update it. I've got to say, Dorothy is a feminist. He empowers women on the set. And you've got this great scene where the woman producer of this farcical musical says, I'm going to gamble on the smartest voice in the room, especially when it's coming from a woman. And that sort of sets the stage for a different...
And I think you just answered why Tootsie. That's why. This highlights the power of stepping into somebody else's shoes and in the process learning about their experience and being able to transfer from sympathy to empathy. And Billy Wilder has a great quote, if you're going to tell people the truth, you better make them laugh or they'll kill you. Yeah. And that's exactly what we're doing. I mean, the fact that we're watching somebody learn from another person's experience and be transformed by it, that's why we're doing it.
There's another twist that updates it. Dorothy comes in and falls in love with this woman, but of course, what can happen between them? Because now she thinks it's a woman. Well, in yours, the woman falls in love with him. And Dorothy, Michael, says, well, I'm not a lesbian. And she says, well, neither am I. Mm-hmm. It's a nod to gender fluidity.
Absolutely.
And it's also, it's a play about stereotypes and breaking stereotypes.
That's what... at first glance may not be obvious, but when you step into it, you realize, oh gosh, this is saying so much about humanity and that we have to find common ground.
I've got to say, I looked at this and I saw a Greek tragedy. The second you put on that dress...
it's inevitable.
It's inevitable. Mm-hmm. And that opening scene, which is that schmaltzy, poorly written, well-written, poorly
on purpose,
written parody
yes.
of Broadway, which when it opens, you think, oh my God, is this the show I've come to? Turns into a Greek chorus.
So glad
and
you
then you've got the
that.
Character, Jeff.
Andy Grote Lucian.
He's your roommate. And I see him as a combination between the Oracle at Delphi and, say, Bob Newhart.
Right? Absolutely.
He's sort of the prophet who all the way through says, don't do it, don't do it, don't do it.
Not long ago, there was a man, an angry guy, awkwardly aging, committed but kind of self-destructive, winding his way through life till ambition and circumstance conspired to deliver an opportunity no one except a megalomaniacal actor with nothing to really lose would consider. So then, of course, this guy puts, oh yeah, this guy is you, in case you were wondering.
And he's got this line that's just classic where he says, at a time when women are literally clutching their power back from between the legs of men, you have the audacity to take a job away from one by impersonating one. And Michael Dorsey doesn't flinch.
He doesn't see it yet. And the show is him gradually being able to see it.
You know, David and I early on realized that the audience needed a window in. The audience needed a point of view saying, you're not going to get away with this. This is a stupid thing to do. What are you doing?
It totally stresses us out in the audience.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Okay, let's talk about the music. So the last time we talked to you, David, you had just finished the musical score and lyrics for The Band's Visit, and it was a personal one for you. You drew on your childhood visits to Lebanon and your grandparents, and you talked about how it was a show without big numbers. Tootsie opens with big numbers and big lyrics and lots of movement. What were you thinking when you jumped into this music right off of that music?
Well, I was bouncing back and forth for a while. There was an overlap period, so it was interesting to be bouncing from that personal, quiet show to what you've just described, this sort of uproarious comedy. And that's incredibly valuable and refreshing to be able to do that. It is the funniest show I've ever seen. A lot of that is because of the two people I'm sitting between on this couch. And, you know, to go into this, what you're calling a Greek tragedy, and deliver these kind of laughs, this is Larry Gelbart, Neil Simon territory, I yes. think.
It's also a show where a lot of the songs are memorable. Certainly the lyrics are memorable. And I felt like I saw some classic Yazbek in there. Sandy Santino's ex-girlfriend, you know, she's neurotic, she's nervous, she's a naysayer and a doomsday waiter, and she has this song, What's Gonna Happen, that reprises throughout the show.
I'll sleep for half an hour, the clock will ring at six. I'll wake up in the shower with a stomach full of bricks, so I won't have any breakfast, maybe just a little you have to go and get a colonoscopy, which incidentally isn't half as disconcerting or upsetting as going for a purge you know there's no way that you're getting.
But I was immediately brought back to Candela in Women on the Verge of a Nervous Breakdown with her Model Behavior song.
You know, I like to think that you can hear me in the songs. In the case of What's Gonna Happen, I don't know, it just felt this is a nervous wreck of a self-fulfilling prophecy. Let's do a patter song. Let's make it a mambo, you know, and really fast, almost too fast for the actress, you know.
I've got to mention this ensemble cast you have. There's Lily Cooper as Julie, who's phenomenal. She plays the love interest of Dorothy and Michael, I suppose. Mm-hmm. And John Bellman as Max Van Horn. He's the not so smart, super buff character. His abs are a character in themselves. And he adds so much comedy to it. And back to Lily Cooper, she has one of the lines in the show that brings it back to a more serious theme, which I want to go back to. When Michael has his downfall, when he falls off his pedestal, he says that he knows that he messed up. And she says, "No, you don't. You think because you walked a mile in a woman's shoes, you suddenly know. Walk 100, walk 1,000, and then fall 1,000 more because there's so much you don't know about so much. And you haven't learned." And she schools you. What does that feel like on stage?
Necessary in order to tell the story. It's the point of the story. And if he hasn't heard that, and he's on the road to beginning to learn, and she does not need to forgive him, but she opens the door, he has to become both aware of it, and other people have to make sure that there's a reckoning.
So I saw this on Thursday night, and there was this great scene. It's one of the final scenes where Dorothy suddenly smacks her glasses off.
My glasses flew off of my wig. We didn't know where they went. I looked around. People in the audience were pointing. Michael McGraw, me and Andy Grotlution were all staring at each other. I then said, "My glasses just got raptured." And then I tried to get Michael back into the scene.
For me, as a jazz guy, those are the moments that I've just loved the most. And everyone on that stage can do that, can riff, you know. It's great.
Thank you. Good luck. Break a leg tonight.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Nobody sees me and nobody listens and nobody cares.
That was Tootsie star Santino Fontana along with show writer Robert Horn and David Yazbek, who wrote the score. All three are Tony nominated. You're listening to Here and Now. Because you believe.
On Bullseye, I talk with people who make amazing work. Greta Gerwig, Errol Morris, A$AP Ferg. The conversations are real and funny, and they take you somewhere unexpected. Find Bullseye with Jesse Thorne on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
The housing market is lagging behind the rest of the economy, with home sales down nearly 5% from a year ago, even as mortgage rates are a full percentage point lower. Jill Schlesinger is business analyst for CBS News and host of Jill on Money. Jill, good to speak with you.
Great to be with you.
So what's going on? Why are these home sales dropping? Unemployment is at a record low. And look at those interest rates. They're falling.
Yeah. And you would think that would bring in a flood of buyers. Look, we are still seeing pretty low, relatively low, I should say, inventory, meaning that there just weren't a lot of homes for sale for a long time. Now, that inventory is starting to creep up. That's good. We saw interest rates pop at the end of last year. That spooked a lot of the buyers out there. We had 5-6% annual increases for a bunch of years. And so that really started to get some of the first-time home buyers completely freaked out, and they just abandoned ship and did not continue to look. They are great renters, though.
Well, should sellers be worried?
Well, I mean, look, I think that sellers have to be more satisfied with the price they're getting and don't expect just huge increases over what the list price is.
Don't expect those bidding wars, right?
Definitely.
Okay, so a 5% drop is average across the board. We know some markets are much better and some markets are much worse. So take us to a city where something interesting is happening.
Let's go to Columbus, Ohio. How about that?
Let's go.
And you're broadcasting from the Boston area. I live in New York. I just came from the Bay Area. These are markets where it's so frothy and crazy that people say they just can't do it anymore. But in Columbus, Ohio, we're looking at a median list price of about $250,000. Well, hey, that will bring a lot of people into a marketplace. We're also seeing some very good action in Texas, where there's been a lot of building, and they're trying to attract a lot of the California folks who don't want to pay high taxes, and maybe their kids are out of school and they're willing to relocate. But I will say there still are some pretty strong markets out there that you have heard of. The Bay Area, though, first time in a while, we saw a decrease of 3% from a year ago. So still, you got to pay almost $1 million for a house.
I was just going to say, maybe we should point out that the median house in the Bay Area costs close to $1 million now. So does it look like that little bubble or that big bubble starting to burst?
I can't see it, because you have all of these unicorn companies going public. So you've got some instant millionaires.
Billionaires,
exactly. And I think that what we're hearing more and more is that people are starting to really scratch their heads and say, wait a second, why am I sticking around here? Maybe I can get my job somewhere else. Like Austin, Texas, or gasp, New York City, because it's cheaper.
Wow. Okay, so one quick thing I want to bring up with you. Over the last 25 years, the average age of a first-time buyer has gone up from 26 years old to 34. So I know you are big on financial advice. What do you say to those 34-year-olds out there who are just about to try and buy their first house?
You know, I think that you still have to run your numbers before you start the process. And it's really good to do a comparison of buying versus renting. The New York Times has a really terrific buy versus rent calculator. And in addition to considering your mortgage principal and interest and the homeowner's insurance and the taxes, please, as a homeowner, let me remind you, upkeep and maintenance, so important. 1-3% of the purchase price, depending on how old the structure is, every single year. Put it in your budget, because you will end up paying for it.
Do your homework, people. This is a gigantic purchase, one you'll have for probably a long time. Jill Schlesinger, business analyst for CBS News and host of Jill on Money. Jill, thanks as always.
Thank you.
On Memorial Day, a day set aside to honor and remember members of the American military killed in action. Earlier today, Vice President Mike Pence placed a wreath at the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier at Arlington National Cemetery. There are parades and ceremonies in communities across the nation today, and we want to take a few minutes now to update a Memorial Day story we've been following for several years. It started with this.
I think I have this right. Do you still drive Jared's truck?
Yes, I do.
There it is. Yep.
Tell me about that truck.
What can I tell you? It's just, it's him. It's got his DNA all over it. I love driving it because it reminds me of him, though I don't need the truck to remind me of him. I think about him every hour of every day.
That's Here and Now's Alex Ashlock speaking in 2011 with Paul Monty at the Massachusetts National Cemetery, where Monty's son Jared is buried. Jared was killed in Afghanistan in 2006, and his father had just started Operation Flags for Vets. He asked volunteers to come to the cemetery to place flags on the graves for Memorial Day and Veterans Day. Well, a songwriter in Nashville heard that conversation and wrote this country song, recorded by Lee Bryce. It's called I Drive Your Truck.
89 cents in the ashtray, half-empty bottle of Gatorade rolling in the floorboard. That dirty Braves cap on the dash, dog tags hanging from the rear view, old skull can and cowboy boots and a gold army shirt.
Paul Monty drove the truck to the cemetery again over the weekend, and Alex Ashlock was there too.
Saturday was a beautiful day on Cape Cod, and people flocked to the National Cemetery to place American flags on the graves there for this Memorial Day.
You got to go down that hill and put them in there.
I parked on the, it's on okay. the street.
No, that's 18, actually.
No. Place your flag at least 3 to 4 inches down into the ground so that it doesn't waver.
There were Vietnam veterans on Harleys, Cub Scouts, and families, many with loved ones buried here. Massachusetts Governor Charlie Baker joined the volunteers.
If you're a family who's lost somebody in combat or in service, every day is Memorial Day for you. And they do value and appreciate it when folks take a few minutes to come out to a ceremony in their community, to visit the cemetery, to plant flags as people are doing here today, and just honor and remember the fact that there are a lot of families who have an empty seat at the table because somebody answered the call.
This is the ninth year for the Memorial Day version of Operation Flags for Vets. I spoke to Paul Monty about that history. And I think I had my numbers right. 50,000 flags when you started. Does that sound about right?
56,000 when we started and 77,000 now. Mm-hmm.
How do you keep up with the supply? How do you keep the supply up with the demand for all these flags these days?
That's not the easiest part. I mean, it's luckily we get to reuse them a number of times because when we order, we want to order enough for everybody at once. Every grave in here has to have the same flag, same quality. No rips, no tears, no frays, no bent sticks. So, you know, we run down. We had a bad year. 2 years ago, we lost 10,000 flags. Last year wasn't as bad. I think we lost 6,000. So we get to that point where we need to reorder, which is big bucks, but we manage.
And people donate money.
Yeah, we have no corporate sponsorship whatsoever. We have no help from the government whatsoever. It's the people that are putting $5 and $10 in a bottle or whatever, and you know, some people are more generous, but that's how it works. It's the little people, and that's really what this is for, is the little people.
Did you ever imagine when you started this 8 years ago that hundreds of people would still be coming out here for Veterans Day and Memorial Day to do this?
No, you know, my brother Matt and I talked about this and in the beginning, and we said 5 years, that'll be about it. So now we're into the ninth year, and it's even stronger. We're expecting maybe as many as 5,000 people here today. And that's just, it's so heartwarming to see those people coming back year after year and bringing their friends, the families that come, the grandparents with the parents, with the kids, you know, the little ones in strollers, and then the 90-year-olds that come with the walkers, and it's just magnificent.
I know you've always said that this isn't about Jared. What is it about?
It's about each and every one of the people buried here that sacrificed so much for our freedom. That's what it's about. When I first got permission to flag the cemetery, or when I was in the process of getting permission, they allowed me to put one flag, and that was Jared's, and I refused. I said, no. He wouldn't want that. He'd be very upset. These are all his buds. These were all the guys that he served with. These are the people he respected. And if I can only do one grave, I won't do any. It's either all or none.
It'll be 13 years next month since he was killed in Afghanistan. Maybe this is a dumb question, but has it gotten any easier?
No. It hasn't, not at all. In fact, in some regards, it's gotten more difficult.
Why is that?
Name recognition. A lot more people know what's going on. And with his particular status and the name recognition,
You mean it keeps it in your mind more because more people know who he is and what happened?
Yeah, this week alone, let's see, 8, 9, 10... This week alone, I'm doing 10 different events.
So you never get away from it?
No, it's every time I begin the process of settling in, I get a reminder. First it was when he was killed, then 3 years later was the Medal of Honor. Then 3 years later was the song that came out, I Drive Your Truck. 3 years later, the book came out. And every time you do an event somewhere, it's sort of like someone saying to you, hey, guess what? Your son is dead. And that's what doesn't allow you to really move on with things because it's just a constant reminder that he's not here anymore.
And we're standing by the truck.
We are standing by the truck.
Yeah. You know, it looks like you maybe got it cleaned up.
I got it painted. I have to preserve that truck, so.
Yeah, it looks beautiful.
I had someone do work on it, and they fixed the rust spots and painted the whole thing.
Looks like a brand new truck.
It really does, yeah. It's great.
And you still drive it?
I still drive the truck, of course. Yeah. I mean, regardless of the song, wouldn't make any difference. That's his truck. He rides with me, and I'm happy to have him aboard.
What's the message for people who might hear this on Memorial Day? What's your message for Memorial Day? What does it mean?
Well, it's really simple. It's, you know, freedom is not free. Someone gave blood. Someone died for your freedom. It really is as simple as that. Freedom isn't free. You want to be free, you got to pay the price. And some people have paid the price more than others. Yesterday, we had a rededication of the monument in Boston for all the Gold Star families from Massachusetts who have lost someone since the terror, yeah. Since 9/11. And, people need to see those things and understand that there are families out there that are grieving and will always grieve for the loss of their loved one.
Paul Monty, speaking with Here and Now's Alex Ashlaw at the Massachusetts National Cemetery. This is Here and Now. I drive your truck. I roll every window down and I burn up. Every back road in this town I find a field. I tear it up till all the pain's a cloud of dust. Yes, and we're still processing the significance of the European election results today. Populists, critical of the EU, increased their clout in Europe's parliament. They'll now control about a quarter of the seats, which is up from 20%. It's not the wave that many expected, but it is another sign that in Europe and around the world, ruling from the center is becoming increasingly rare. Derek Thompson is senior editor at The Atlantic, and he joins us now. Derek, thanks for being here on a holiday.
Great to be here. Thank you.
Sure. So most Americans, I don't think it's a stretch to say, don't usually pay too much attention to the European parliamentary elections. But just make the case for why this vote mattered a lot more than usual.
Absolutely. I think most Americans can be forgiven for not following European politics, especially on an American holiday. But let me make the case that these elections matter a lot. I strongly believe that in the last few years, Europe has been a canary in the coal mine for American politics, an early warning system. Before you had Bernie Sanders, you had democratic socialism across Europe. Before you had a revival of anti-immigrant sentiment here, you saw anti-immigration movements sweeping across the European continent. And then, of course, before you had Donald Trump, you had Brexit, that famous expression of nationalism and right-wing populism. So transatlantic currents blow to the east, but political winds seem to blow to the west, across the Atlantic, from Europe to the American coast. So if you want to learn about the future of American politics, I think you should strongly pay attention to what's happening in Europe right now.
Interesting. And, you know, speaking of Brexit, in the UK, the new Brexit Party did very well. But overall, generally speaking, some people were fearing a much bigger populist wave across Europe than actually panned out. Well, why do you think it didn't happen that way?
So big picture here. Until recently, Europe was governed by center-left and center-right parties. It was a bit like here in the U.S., that you had centrists like, say, Bill Clinton, George H.W. Bush. But with this election, it's become clear that populists on both the left and the right are insurgent. Yes, there was a lot of fear before these elections that this would be a blowout win for right-wing populists, and it wasn't just that. Instead, what you saw is that voters across Europe in Spain, in Italy, in France, in Greece, they're rejecting centrist politics and they're embracing outsiders to both the left and the right. They're essentially saying we want an end to politics as usual. And I think that going forward, what's going to happen is it's going to make Europe harder to govern. Because if you elect a lot of centrists and they can create coalitions, they can pass laws, they can express the will of the people in legislation. But if you elect a bunch of people to the far left and a bunch of people to the far right, they can't talk to each other. So what you have instead is a recipe for rolling chaos.
You make a very interesting point. Before this election, all the talk was that the populists were going to do very well, that the nationalist parties would do very well. And yet, lo and behold, here are the Greens and the Liberals, as you say, eroding the center from the left. How do you think that happened?
Well, I think that you can see some of its parallels right here in the U.S. On the one hand, you have the right, which essentially has been co-opted by Donald Trump, someone who was initially seen at the beginning of the primaries in 2015 as being far too radical on issues like immigration to be a mainstream Republican. Now he enjoys over 80% of approval within the Republicans. So on the one hand, you can see far-right energies in the Republican Party. But look in the Democratic Party. Yes, because of name recognition and familiarity, you do have Joe Biden polling very strongly. We'll see how his popularity holds up the next few months. But you've also had a lot of energy around Bernie Sanders, around Elizabeth Warren. You have lots of Democrats signing on to a Medicare for All plan, essentially a socialist or democratic socialist health care plan, which has enjoyed a lot of popularity among the Democratic Party. So in Europe, as in the U.S., what you see is insurgencies on both the far left and the far right, rather than a sort of rather than the power of respectability centrist pulling through.
Take a look at what's happening all around the world. It is not just Europe. It is not just the United States. We saw a big win for India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi last week. He is a Hindu nationalist. And then look at Australia. Voters very recently decided to keep the Prime Minister Scott Morrison in power. Now, he's an evangelical Christian. He denies climate change. He is very strict against immigration. This is happening all around the globe.
It's happening all over the globe. And the economist and political commentator Tyler Cowen wrote in Bloomberg that the new right is beating the new left everywhere. I think so far that seems somewhat true. It is more broadly applicable to say that the new right is beating the old center everywhere. Voters are afraid that the global movement of capital and people, that is immigrants, are taking away their power, their money, their control, and they're using these new tools of technology and the internet to protest day in and day out, to point out the flaws in establishment government, and it's causing this sort of, as I said, rolling chaos of insurgency all over the globe.
Well, that is pretty interesting to see what will happen as these governments all around the globe are moving away from the center. Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. Happy Memorial Day.